We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
From the Clark Ford Studio in Oxford, Mississippi, MBW Digital proudly presents the Oxford Exxon Podcast.
I'd say thanks for tuning in, but why am I going to give you a round of applause for something that you're supposed to do, to be frank?
And now, here are your hosts, Chase Palm.
And broadcast school has really paid off.
And Neil McCready.
I deserve to be on TV.
Welcome into this Monday edition of the Oxford Exxon Podcast. Chase Palm, Brian Rippey here with you. Nobody's in the Clark Sports Studio today, but I'll tell you about that here momentarily. I am coming to you from Florida. Brian back in Oxford. He had a weekend in New Orleans over the weekend. He was at a wedding. You got your own wedding here coming up in a couple weeks, but we might have a few of those topics and more coming up on what was a bit of an interesting weekend of Ole Miss athletics. You look at the basketball team, they no-show completely losing to Texas A&M on Saturday in the regular season finale, 86-60. I think they might get those same Aggies coming up in the first round of the SEC tournament here on Thursday as they just avoid playing on Wednesday for another season. They are the 10th seed in the SEC tournament. Look at that bracket for whatever it matters. And then the baseball team, they sweep Morehead State. A Morehead State team that's not terrible, actually. I thought Ole Miss played pretty good baseball most of the weekend. I know you just wrapped up a podcast with Colin, so you guys probably talked about that a little bit or a lot of bit there during that show as well. But a lot of stuff coming up on here with you today. The Oxford Exxon, all Blue Sky locations. Again, we're telling you more about Blue Skies everywhere here starting now and moving into the future as podcast partnership expanding a little bit there to all their convenience stores statewide, up and down I-55 throughout North Mississippi as well. You've got lunch specials, $5.69, couple sides, bread, any size fountain drink. You got the Sweet Daddy's, pulled pork, ribs, tons of options there up and down I-55, as I said, throughout Blue Skies. The Clark Ford Studios at Amory, Mississippi, or Clark Ford's in Amory, Mississippi, 662-257-1900, Highway 25 South. Corey wants to be your truck guy, wants to be your car guy. He will take care of you no matter where you are in the car buying process. Let Corey help you. Give him a call. He just might surprise you, give you the best deal on a new car, move you along with that faster than you expected. And again, the Campbell Clinic is now in Oxford for all your orthopedic needs. Give him a call. They will take care of you. Again, now in Oxford. Brian, good evening. We're recording this pretty late, about 9:20. Central time, 10:23, where I'm at, doing a few days, almost close to a week here at Disney. And let me give a quick shout out first off, because I was getting a little worried. I told you, I said, hey, I'm going to go to the lobby. I'm going to find a place to sit and record and make this work. And it's really freaking loud. So I knew that, like, in my room, I could probably find a spot, but I was going to wake somebody up, at least keep them from going to bed here tonight. So I thought I'll just head over to the lobby, but 10:30 is not late enough to get people out of there. There was music playing. I walked up to the front desk. Even the business center was really, really loud. You couldn't focus on a podcast even where the business center was. And I said, hey, I've got a problem here. I need to record a podcast of all things. I know you don't know who I am. You don't know what that's going to mean at all, but anything you could help me with. And they've put me in this little bitty room that says cast members only. And I don't know what's supposed to be in here, but I have like a table, a couple more chairs. It is like the perfect podcast studio. This room is like 10 by 10 or something like that. I mean, I need to bottle this thing up and take it with me. So credit to Disney. I appreciate it. They don't know me from Adam, but they hooked me up with a location for the podcast tonight.
cast members only. So someone in like a Daffy Duck or suit or like Mickey Mouse going to come in and accost you halfway through the podcast. That is a nice setup you have there, but I'm curious what constitutes cast members only. But yeah, been a while since I've been to Disney. I did it once when I was a kid and haven't been back. That's not really reflective of how I felt about that experience. I was like 10, just haven't gone back. But I remember it being fun. That was quite a while ago at this point, though.
Yeah, it's one of those deals where I think Disney in probably only this way is like Vegas, where you can make it whatever you want to make it. You know what I mean? You can go to Vegas and do whatever you want to do. And Disney's kind of like that, too. You can go be inundated with the parks and running like crazy, but you can find a lot better dining. You can do that. You got golf. You got spas. You can kind of make Disney whatever you want to make Disney. But when your child is turning 8 and in a couple of weeks, it's pretty clear what you're trying to do there. So anyway, just credit to them. I was a little shocked. I was beginning to worry a little bit on where I was about to set up. I was contemplating going and just sitting out on like one of the balconies or out by the, I'm using air quotes because they're not the actual beach right here, but like the beach behind the resort. But it's all good. We ended up in this little room and she said, hey, just be aware if you leave, the door's going to lock and you won't be able to get back in. And I was like, well, that's not a problem. I just need this bad boy for like an hour or so. And she said, no worries. So I don't know where to start, and I'm going to start with basketball simply because you and Colin have talked a ton of baseball, and we'll get to that, but we've got a main show on the network that's doing a ton of baseball. Again, Texas A&M just routes Ole Miss. I think they scored the first 15 points of the game, 14 points of the game, something like that. They were leading the Rebels there, and Ole Miss, other than one little bit of a run to get back within 12 or something there in the first half, just not even competitive. And what was most interesting, and Neil wrote about this in 10 Thoughts, was the postgame. Chris Beard brings Cam Brent, Wayne Brent's kid, the walk-on, to the press conference, says that he actually has heart. He calls out other players on the team without actually using anybody's name, says that he needs a team next year that cares about the name on the front, not just the name on the back. I think to steal a quote from, I think Herb Brooks from Miracle might be where that quote originated, but nonetheless, we'll give it to Beard here. And two things stuck out. One, and we'll break these down one by one, so I'm not even going to mention them both right here. We'll start with number one, and I'll go to number two in a second, is, you know, we talked about his temperament, demeanor all year. He didn't look like the same guy that was at Texas Tech, at Texas, as fiery as he has been in the past. And I think it served two purposes. Now that the regular season is over and Ole Miss finishes with 20 wins, but let's be honest, considering at one point they were 5-3 in the SEC, this has been quite the close to finish 7-11 in the SEC. It was what was probably needed because it was a team that had been beaten down with losses for years. I don't think they knew how to win necessarily. I think they were front runners. And I don't mean that even critically as in personality. I mean that as in when they could get going and get some momentum, they played pretty good basketball. It's why they were pretty good at home for a lot of the year. And kind of hit shots and did some things and just sort of willed it through that way. But I think now looking back, it was indicative of a team that he thought was probably pretty soft mentally, probably pretty soft from a discipline standpoint, and frankly, a team that is not in his image at all. I kind of am getting a different read because when you listen to these Chris Beard thoughts, Brian, you're getting a guy that, I don't mean about the kids personally, but I mean as far as the team element, didn't like this team, frustrated by this team, felt like he could not coach discipline into this team at all, to the point that he said, hey, you need to ask the players these questions. I don't know, because they're the ones that have to decide to do it. I guess when you look at the totality, what are you seeing here? What do you sort of feel was, and I know we're putting thoughts in his mind here, but what do you sort of make of the year-long way Beard has tried to coach this team and how that correlates to the thoughts that he had on Saturday afternoon?
I think it was a team that probably, I'd be curious now to go back and if you could ask Chris Beard after they beat, I could pick Mississippi State or Memphis, one of those wins they had at home where it felt like the team was turning a corner and a hell of a lot better than they were going to be, how surprised he was that it was happening. Because it came very apparent as this team came back down to earth and really fizzled out down the stretch. Two wins since the calendar turned to February and they're both Memphis. Missouri. Yeah, not Memphis. Sorry. That this team was probably somewhere in the middle of what they showed in the season's first 6 to 8 weeks and what they showed in the last 2 months of the season. And I'd be curious if he's surprised, because I'm not sure. It became evident towards the second half of the season that, as you mentioned, he didn't really love this team, didn't really like the way they played at times. And when talking to Bracken throughout the year, he had alluded to it a couple of times. Bracken mentioned in a couple of their losses, and I can't remember which ones in this very moment, but just at a certain point, he'd just get to the point where he'd say, and I question sometimes the defensive effort. And I know Beard, defensively driven coach, that probably had to have driven him absolutely insane. And he was frustrated after a couple of losses this year. Saturday, of course, sounds like it took the cake. I didn't get to watch much on Saturday. It didn't sound like I missed a whole hell of a lot. But he's probably frustrated that, yeah, this team wasn't great, and this team probably didn't have very high expectations, and maybe put some false higher expectations on themselves due to a hot start and a weak-ish non-conference schedule. But I think it's just the fact that how they fizzled out, they weren't playing hard. They essentially just no-showed on senior day. That really probably had to rub him the wrong way, because, you know, defense and rebounding were two teams that this did terribly, and I imagine that has to keep any college basketball coach up at night, particularly Chris Beard.
Well, yeah, I mean, you mentioned the game. To me, that sticks out is that Mississippi State game. That was January 30th, 2024. Ole Miss wins 86-82. That win made them 18-3 overall and 14-7. I mean, sorry, 5-3 in the SEC. State was 14-7 at the time. 18-3 overall, 5-3 in the SEC. And again, you're right. It's Missouri and Ells the rest of the way. That's what they've had. And they haven't played anywhere near a semblance of a complete game. You know, look, their best game in that stretch was probably Georgia, because they would have won the game with Matthew Morrell. He was out with an illness. They probably do okay. But, you know, once the very lofty possibilities, I hate to call them expectations, because having expectations for this team feels really weird the way it went down. But at the time it did, you know, if you can take that snapshot of, I covered that game for our site when they beat Mississippi State, and you're writing about a team that, you know, has to go 5-5 the rest of the way. They're, you know, they're hot at home. Can they win this game? Can they win this game? It was all about possibilities. But then once those popped, it's a team that, you know, look, we've been really careful on this podcast to say the key word, that a team quit, because there's so much that goes into that, and it's never every player. You know what I mean? When you say a team quit, you're calling out 15 guys on a basketball team, and that's not the case. But let's also not kid ourselves and say that the complete focus, effort, discipline, the things that are needed to win games has been there since then, because it hasn't. You know, there are two snapshots of where this team had some possibilities, and they went away where they regressed back to the mean. They did things in those ways that simply were what they looked like in years past, what you kind of expected from them before the hot start. And that's the Mississippi State game, and then that's halftime of the Auburn game. They came right after that, because they were ahead at halftime. They held like a 7-point lead, whatever it was, on Auburn at halftime, and then the Tigers just blitzed them. Now, you knew Auburn was going to make a run. They had not made anything in the first half, if you look back on that. But just a straight score standpoint, Ole Miss had a lead at halftime, and they have not been able to put two halves together at all. Their only probably postseason chances, period, are to win the SEC tournament, and good luck if you feel like that's even on the table in any way. Ole Miss doesn't need to go to the NIT, and frankly, I don't think they're an NIT team anyway. I don't think they're a team that could ever get a bid to the NIT. That's harder than it was 20 years ago, and I don't know that everybody fully either understands or just takes that into account, because any regular season tournament champion that does not win the conference tournament gets an invitation to the NIT now. So it's not just 32 Power 5 teams that happen to have some decent seasons over 500 and get there. It's a season, though, that changes the dynamics in a lot of ways from what we expected, at least right there in that snapshot I mentioned and where this thing fizzled and ended. And it's a team that, I mean, look, he came out and said it. Chris Beard apologized to fans, said that he hadn't even wanted to talk to Keith to figure out how to refund their money, if at all possible, that they didn't deserve to pay to watch the product that was on the court, which is him taking responsibility there. I mean, that's him taking it on himself, not just putting it on the players. And I guess that's where I'm going with part two here. I'm just kind of setting everything up, is that, look, I know Nick Saban once said he wasn't coaching Alabama. I get all that stuff. There's no offer currently on the table. So he did the only thing that made sense in the moment. So I'm not being naive here. However, in saying that, there's been some talk about Chris Beard's body language or his quotes, or if he was dialed in or looking to the future or settled in Oxford and all those things. And I'm not going to speak for him, because, hell, I don't know. But he did in no way spoke like a guy who was leading on Saturday. He spoke like a guy who was frustrated, who was the coach of this team now and moving forward, and that all of his sights were put on finding not just the talent necessary to compete in the SEC, but frankly, the mentality, the discipline, and the type of kid that is needed to compete in the SEC, and that's where his focus was. I mean, he gave a press conference that if you're kind of wondering if he would give some glimpse either way, the glimpse was that he is much more worried about year two at Oxford than anything else.
I agree with that. And I think he will probably, again, who knows, but I think he will probably end up back here for year two. But he spoke like a guy that really wanted to retool the roster and get kids that fit the DNA of what he thinks comprises a pretty competitive basketball team. And he's put together several of those through the years. And with this team, too, it wasn't just the way it happened down the stretch. There were just several instances of, like, I go to the two South Carolina games where, and I'm hesitant to bring this specific example up because a couple games later, Beard mentioned that Brakefield, he actually went out of his way after one of these games to mention Brakefield had been playing through a lot of injuries. But there you had that end of that first half where they got down and they got in a hole, and Brakefield allowed like a pretty easy dunk where the guy caught it like four to 8 feet from the basket, took one power dribble, jump stop, and dunked, and it was almost like it was uncontested in a way. And I don't think Brakefield played the rest of that night. And I don't mean to single him out as an example. But then the other South Carolina game, you know it's at home. You know essentially your season in NCAA tournament hopes on the line. And you get down in a big hole, but honestly look pretty lethargic on the defensive end of the floor, really both ends of the floor, for large stretches of that game. And I remember there was an Andy Kennedy game way back when in like 2013 or 14 where he had a post-game press conference where he was like, how do you come out that lethargic in a game like that? It boggles my mind. That Beard's press conference felt a little bit like that after that night. So he's frustrated with like the lack of urgency in some of the biggest moments of this team season. And so to tie all of that together, he definitely spoke like a guy on Saturday afternoon that is frustrated with the current state of his roster and the effort given. And he sounds like a guy that wants to drastically reshape it and put a team out on the floor that is not going to wilt in March.
Well, and it's a roster that you look ahead to next season and go ahead and do that a little bit. A roster that is going to be built from a returner standpoint around Jamin Brakefield and Juju Murray. You need a lot. You need a lot of NIL. You need to go get a lot of dudes. I don't know where John Bowl is or isn't as far as helping immediately as a freshman next year, all those different things. But, you know, I just look at it, and I don't want to be a broken record, so I'm just going to mention this and kind of move on. But this job, this – frankly, era we're in college athletics, it's nothing more than what does the BAM paycheck look like? What's out there to go beat other teams for these players? Because when Chris Beard is saying all this, what's going through my head a little bit is that, sure, he had to do this at Texas in year one before everything went down there. But, and look, we're guilty of it too, because there are some parallels, but there are also some complete not parallels. He didn't make the NCAA tournament. He didn't make the postseason his first year at Texas Tech. They were under 500 in Big 12 play. They weren't very good. But that was traditional recruiting. There's nothing about this that's traditional recruiting. You're not just simply building this up from the high school ranks and whatnot. No, I mean, what you're doing is letting Chris Beard's reputation take hold, hoping that matters, using connections everywhere you can use them, and hoping that he can get into the portal here soon. He was hired 361 days ago, something like that, as of right now, if I'm looking at it correctly. Basically the same time frame, except he already has everything in place. This thing's about, as soon as they were eliminated in Nashville, hitting the portal, hitting it as hard as hell, and finding not just one or two dudes. Kind of looks like the baseball retooling a little bit. I think there's parallels in that standpoint. You're talking about several difference makers, especially in the front court. Look, you've got to get some offensive help in the damn front court. I mean, their problem, if you had to identify one problem, it was defense, it was rebounding, it was all those things. But inside of that, the problem was that their front court had zero offensive presence at all. And when you have zero offensive presence in that way, it just clutters everything up. The ball sticks so much more. It puts more pressure on your defense. And I guess where I'm going with that is this isn't just some easy reload. This is going out and finding difference makers in both parts of the offensive game, defensive game that make this thing work. I mean, I'm not saying he can't do it. I'm not saying he doesn't have the money. I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying I'm fascinated to see the direction and kind of the way he does this. I think that the architect of putting next year's roster together, when he's thinking about personalities and cultures and all these things combined with what's needed talent-wise, I mean, it's an incredibly fascinating thing just from a straight sports story standpoint. I mean, it might be my favorite story of the offseason as we get into this thing as it goes.
And just creating a roster that makes sense. This team really didn't make any sense. And it's not a knock on anybody. I mean, I've mentioned Colin and I talked a little basketball at the end, but like your first year head coach, your hands are tied from a roster construction standpoint and a scheduling standpoint, just because of the lack of time, you know, depending on when you get hired, everything's new. You got to put together a staff and then you got to go get portal kids and you just lose time there. Like this team, as you mentioned, I mean, they had absolutely nothing in the front court offensively. Really, they struggled again defensively when they would bring whether it was Sharp, Cisse was a little bit better at it, fives against other guards. Like you were basically like only getting rim protection. You were getting no offense and really not really much of a boost defensively other than some decent rim protection. And that's tough for a team that really didn't have overly dynamic guards other than Matthew Morrell to play 5-on-4 offensively. And so I think I would be fascinated to see how he constructs this roster next year. I think there will be a lot more method to the madness, where it felt like this year is just go get as much talent as you can and try to figure it out. Obviously, there was some sort of fit that went into it, but again, limited amount of time. This is going to be kind of his first blown off-season project where he has a legitimate off-season to construct a roster that I think is more in his image and how he wants to play. And I'm with you. I'm fascinated to see what it looks like, because if there's a guy that can go get players that don't typically consider or go to Ole Miss, it's certainly him. He's got the track record. He's got the pedigree. I'm just curious to see who he gets and what that team looks like.
This podcast is brought to you by BetterHelp. What's the first thing you do if you got an extra hour in your day? Go for a run, take a nap, read a book, show up for a friend. A lot of us spend our lives wishing we had more time. But if time was unlimited, how would you use it? Best way to squeeze that special thing into your schedule is to know what's important to you and make it a priority. Therapy can help you find what matters to you so you can do more of it. You know, you give therapy a shot. It's a great way to connect with people, to get thoughts and ideas and help. No preconceived notion, no emotion coming from the other side. Family and friends sometimes bring their baggage onto you. So avoid that with a trained professional. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, suited to your schedule. Fill out a questionnaire, get matched with a licensed therapist. You can even switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. So you can learn what time for what makes you happy. Visit BetterHelp, BetterHelp.com/MPW today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/MPW.
Our next partner is Athletic Greens. I drink AG1 by Athletic Greens literally every day. I give AG1 a try because I want a better gut health, sustained energy, immune system support, and I just hate taking those big supplement pills. I drink AG1 every morning. I love knowing I'm doing something good for my body, giving my body the nutrition it craves, and covering my nutritional bases. Covering my nutritional basis for the day literally couldn't be easier, which is why I trust Athletic Greens. I just mix one small scoop of AG1 with water and drink it first thing each morning. Done. I also like that it costs less than $3 a day. It's pretty good if you ask me. It's a really effective daily habit with the highest quality sourced ingredients. It's a win-win. If a comprehensive solution is what you need for your supplement routine, then Athletic Greens is giving you a free one-year supply of vitamin D and 5 free travel packs with your first purchase. Go to athleticgreens.com/MPW. That's athleticgreens.com/MPW. Check it out. Are you retiring soon? How long should you wait to take Social Security? What accounts should you pull from first? Are you already retired? Should you consider Roth conversions? These are just some of the questions that can only be answered with a personalized retirement income plan. Andrew Sego with Sego Wealth Management specializes in helping folks just like you come up with their retirement game plan. Whether you meet at his office in Collierville or prefer Zoom from anywhere, schedule a free discovery meeting. See what they can do for you. It's rebelsretire.com. We're brought to you by Comer Heating and Air, Southern Air Conditioning and Heating. Different names, same great products and services. If you live in Oxford, Batesville, Tupelo, or the surrounding area, call Comer 662-8011. 777. If you live in Hernando, Memphis, or the surrounding area, call Southern 662-429-4429. If you're coming up this weekend for baseball, for basketball, stop by the College Corner right off the Sisk Avenue in the Oxford Commons. More than 4,000 square feet of the very best Rebel gear. Plenty of parking available. Their staff will have you in and out ready for Swayze or the Pavilion in no time. Also, two locations in the Jackson area. And you can check them out online at collegecornerstore.com.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
So the SEC tournament is set for the week. That is at Bridgestone Arena in Nashville beginning on Wednesday, March 13th. At 6 o'clock, Vanderbilt plays Arkansas. That's a 13-12 game. And then 25 minutes after that game, Georgia and Missouri in the 14-11 game. Did Missouri end up finishing winless in the league? Did LSU beat them on Saturday? I haven't even seen a score.
I believe so, but I'll double-check that really quick. I believe they ran the table in reverse. A year after being kind of one of the shocks of the conference to go to the NCAA tournament, that's a tough one. Yes, they went 0-18.
Oh, God. Okay. So they did lose it. Again, as we said the other day, that is the first time in a few years that it happened. Vanderbilt under Bryce Drew a few years ago went 0-0 in the SEC, and then those two were the first time since Georgia Tech in the 1950s to pull that feat. And then prior to that, there was not one ever that was not either war-related where they played fewer games, like World War II, when I say that, or Sewanee, who did it six times during their SEC run back in the 40s or 50s or whatever the hell that was.
He also scheduled them pretty hard in the non-conference season, so if you just want to like take a snapshot of how draining it must be to go through a schedule like that, whether it's a player or as a fan, they won one basketball game from December 3rd on.
December 3rd.
They beat Wichita State. And then he had three in a row where he had them play at Kansas, Seton Hall, and at Illinois, and they lost that. So they had a December 30th win against Central Arkansas, and that was their last one of the year. So from December 4th, I guess, technically, to the end of the year, they won one basketball game. That sounds pretty miserable.
Two games on Thursday are set, number 9, Mississippi State, number 8, LSU. That is at noon, and then at 6, already mentioned Ole Miss and Texas A&M. Ole Miss, the 10 seed, A&M, the 7 seed. That is at 6 o'clock there on that Thursday. The winner gets number 2 seed Kentucky, who is just playing out of its mind, frankly. I know I get everything involved with them, but you look at it overall, Kentucky, a team that nobody's going to want to see in March, just the way that offensively that team is playing. They knock off Tennessee. They've been damn good. And then Mississippi State, maybe a must win. I think they've lost 4 in a row. The net's still in pretty good shape. They look like a tournament team for the majority of the game, but they're not closing games. They're not winning. They lose to South Carolina in overtime on Saturday. So if you want to just pencil one with some significance, Mississippi State better for sure beat LSU there in the first game on Thursday. But again, Ole Miss and A&M, game 5, 6 o'clock. If you told me there's maybe not a bracket buster, because I'm not going to make the SEC tournament out to be this thing that really, really matters in a lot of ways. But I'm intrigued by Arkansas. I think they're going to get by Vanderbilt there on Wednesday. And in a 12-5 game, and maybe this is me continuing to undervalue South Carolina, even though I'm not. They're safely in the SEC tournament. Lamont Paris would definitely be my SEC coach of the year. He's done a phenomenal job. I love Michi Johnson. Like, there's lots about that. There's so much about that team that I like, and they won one hell of a game Saturday in Starkville against Mississippi State with a state team that was frantic for a win after the way things are closed. But Carolina also is completely safe. They don't need that game in any way. I don't think Arkansas is about to make some crazy run, but I wouldn't hate an Arkansas money line on South Carolina there on Thursday if the Razorbacks get past the Commodores.
They've played much better basketball for the last month after they got absolutely shellacked against Tennessee at home. They had that game go down to the wire on the road at Mississippi State where you could argue they could, should, have, would, whatever you want to say, won that game. But they were up in that game late. Then they win two in a row at A&M Missouri. Somehow throw a Vanderbilt loss in there at home because it's Arkansas. But then they were up late in the second half at Kentucky and at Alabama, the two losses sandwiched in between an LSU in the last two of the last three games of the season. So I'm with you. They're playing better basketball. Seems like a lot of the drama or whatever you want to call it they had going on, at least it's in their rear view. They're not really playing for anything other than the right to play again another day. So that's kind of – if you have a team like that in the SEC tournament with, like, talent, that is kind of what the equivalent of a bracket buster would be in Nashville.
Six teams are safely in the NCAA tournament from the SEC. Tennessee's the one seed in Nashville. Kentucky, the two. Alabama, the three. Auburn, the four. Obviously, all those are fine. South Carolina's the five. They're completely good. They're in the NCAA tournament with a pretty good seed. And then Florida at number six is safely in as well. Florida gets the winner of Missouri and Georgia in the late game on Thursday. And then they win that one. I would be really intrigued by a quarterfinal of Florida and Alabama on Friday. I think that'd be a hell of a game.
I would too. Sign me up for that. That does sound like a hell of a game.
Standings-wise, just kind of quickly, did Kentucky end up tying Tennessee for the conference title?
No, I believe Tennessee.
Tennessee still won it outright? Okay.
Yes.
That is correct. There is a four-way tie for second. Tennessee won the SEC at 14-4. South Carolina, Auburn, Kentucky, and Alabama all 13-5.
There's apparently a scenario out there entering the week that you could have had a six-way tie at the top. And with the four-way tie at second, I would say they narrowly missed whatever that scenario was.
Women's NCAA tournament, by the way, Ole Miss loses to LSU on Saturday. I'm not going to spend a ton of time on this, frankly, just because I've been out of pocket a little bit. But they knock off Florida on Friday. They lose to LSU in the semis, safely in the NCAA tournament. And just for everybody's purposes here, March 17th at 7 o'clock is Selection Sunday for the women. So the same time as the men, same day there. Just after those come out, and then the first round of the SEC tournament for the women will be March 22nd, 23rd for the first round, March 22nd, 23rd there in the NCAA tournament. They now call the first four just the first four. It's no longer the first round of the NCAA tournament, so that makes me feel a little better when I say it out loud. It's not as confusing as we move forward there, but one hell of a job by them getting back to the semis, getting a top four seed of the regular season. I mentioned this last week, losing your starting point guard earlier in the year, making it work with some other ways. I mean, as much as Beard struggled with finding an identity, it's taken McCune a while here. I mean, it's not like this is year one at all and has done a phenomenal job of building that roster up, that team up. But more than anything else, they play in her identity and they play in a way that you know exactly who you're watching on the floor when they're on it.
Yeah, she's done a hell of a job. I mean, go to the tournament back-to-back years, you have the big upset at Stanford last year that felt like it put them on the map. And going to the tournament, this would be the third straight year they were in the tournament, correct?
I believe that's correct. Yeah, they got beat by South Dakota, I believe, 2 years ago.
And given what she took over, I mean, it's hard to knock that. What she's done is very, very impressive. And I don't have a bad thing to say about it. I'll be interested to see kind of what their ceiling is this year. But kudos to her, because that was not not an easy rebuild, I should say, that she was taking over.
Apparently, we had a hell of a fight between South Carolina and LSU today. Did you see that?
I did.
Out of pocket.
There was like a timeout. I think someone from LSU had hit a shot, and she starts chirping the South Carolina way. She shoves her. Maybe I had this backwards. And then one of the South Carolina, I would assume, front court players came in and just absolutely de-cleated whoever was talking shit for LSU, just destroyed them. So things start getting chippy after that. And then it starts like looking weirder because like a cop jumps over the scores table to help break things up. So anytime you see a badge getting involved in a scuffle, it just looks escalated. And then apparently a fan or somebody jumped over the edge to try to get in the mix. I didn't see a ton about this, but the broadcast mentioned it when I was watching the video clip. I didn't actually see the fan, but yeah, anytime you have a fan and law enforcement in the middle of a player scuffle, it's definitely something that'll probably make some headlines.
Yeah, I saw Don Staley's response was basically, hey, this kind of thing happens when there's competitiveness. And then Kim Mulkey, the LSU fiery head coach, obviously, her quote was more like, I wish they had pushed Angel Reese instead, that you picked on somebody half your size, was basically the essence of her quote.
Fair point, I guess. Yeah, I mean, there was a size in the main takedown that really escalated it. There was an absolute size disadvantage. I did see and catch enough from that.
So you're agreeing with Kim Mulkey is what you're saying.
I'm not saying I agree with her. That, I mean, I would just say just somebody hit somebody if you really wanted to see some action. But I mean, she is factual in the fact that there was an absolute size disadvantage. I will corroborate her there. I will not say I agree with her.
Okay, fair enough. So I got a couple thoughts. What was the overall gist? I'll let you tease a little bit, and clearly this is on NPW Digital as well. What was Collins' overall sort of takeaway, your takeaway of this past weekend and kind of where this team is sitting heading into conference play?
That probably in two of the four major facets of baseball, they're fine. I think they hit pretty well. I think the bullpen's really good. I don't really understand why the defense is so bad, and all eyes are on starting pitching. And with the way the starting pitching performed this weekend, I think you just roll it back one more weekend until you're really given a reason not to. I think that reason will probably come if they struggle on Friday nights like they did last year and just really don't have much of a chance. But that was really kind of it. I think it was – we talked about the floor of this team being raised in terms of expectations, where there was a point after, like, high point where it's like, oh, yep, 5-25 is in play again. Maybe some kind of all-time historic mark here, whereas now – if this team like bottoms out and they don't end up being any good, I think that looks more like 10-20. And they lost a couple close games because they didn't get good enough starting pitching. And you're not really in the mix for an at-large bid the last two weekends because you just couldn't close out a couple crucial games and series. And I think they probably fall somewhere in the middle. So I think it's raising the floor and then just can they get competent starting pitching?
Are we still keeping the over-under on this team at 14 SEC wins?
Yes. Yeah, I'm comfortable with 14.
It's an over-under.
Yeah. If this team went 15, maybe 13.5, that way 14 and 16, you kind of hit it. But yeah, it's somewhere in that window. That feels fair. 14 and 16 to push, that feels perfectly fair with this team.
I think one question comes to mind because, no, look, no matter what you think of this team and our listeners, people on the message board, there's going to be wildly different takes. Some people are going to think it's all fixed. Some people are going to think they're going to suck no matter what. But the one thing that I do think is evident is that unlike the first two series of the season, for sure, Hawaii and then High Point, is they looked like a team playing inferior competition is supposed to look against them when you're an SEC team. You know what I mean? Like, I get today was 6-5 for a final. We're recording this again on Sunday night, but Ole Miss dominated the first two games of the series. They were clearly better than Morehead State. I mean, they did everything well. They did everything better. There was nothing that Morehead State did to kind of freak them out in any way other than this 5-run inning that happened today, and it's baseball, and I'm not going to hold that against anybody in some crazy way because I still trust Josh Mallett and him and most of the bullpen for the most part. They look better, as you were alerted to there. I mean, the bullpen is throwing strikes. They're hitting the baseball, they're taking walks, they're doing some things analytically that make some sense offensively. The defense on paper should be okay, at least. It shouldn't be a really SEC inferior defense. So that's troubling that we are how many ever games we are into the season now. But at the same time, I mean, a lot of these guys have played college baseball before. We have a sample size of what this is supposed to look like. I still think they have some issues at catcher from a defensive standpoint, but you're not fixing that. It is what it is. You can decide to play Birch or Smithwick, and there's positives to both, but you're not fixing that on the totality from that standpoint. And then you're completely right about starting pitching, and we'll get to that in a second, but I really agree with you from the standpoint of they just look better. There is an eye test element to this, and, you know, look, but those first 2 weeks – I mean, dude, it was bad. I mean, it was a baseball team that was in Hawaii, and I know Hawaii's not great by any means. I know they're not terrible by any means. I know they're just kind of in the middle, and I understand that. But at the same time, it was a team that was scuffling for an identity to do anything overly well. They lose a game to High Point there on that Friday night. Still can't hit. They lose to Arkansas State. But you look up, and they've won 10 of their last 11 at this point. They're playing pretty good baseball and doing a lot of things. And it's predicated – I know their hitting is the most flashy thing, and I'll get to that in a second. But from a pitching standpoint, you just look at what they've done. Starting pitching-wise, that's a lot of games now where guys have gone at least five innings outside of Liam Doyle only throwing 3.1 because he was on a pitch count on Saturday. Saunier's got multiple games in a row of at least five innings. Dennis, same thing. The Maddox in the midweek fixed things kind of after the first inning. He got that sinker rolling. He gave you a very long outing against a Memphis team that's okay. They don't suck. They're not great by any means, but you play who you play. I thought that mentally the starting pitching is so much better than it was earlier in the year. They have a little more confidence. They have a little more expectation about them. They're throwing the ball in the strike zone, which they weren't doing. They're showing a few multiple pitches. I'm not going to say they're going to go lead the league in ERA or anything, but I do think there's a path to this being a respectable group of starting pitching because, look, in today's college baseball, there are two things. Walk offensively and don't walk people on the mound. And with their strike rate coming up and them making people put the ball in play, I do think that's going to translate to longer outings and more outs as a staff right now.
I do too. I'm curious to see how the rotation actually shakes out. I think it's better than maybe what we thought it could be at the beginning of the year. I think there's more options. Colin told me that he had a guy text him and say, you know, Ole Miss has three pretty good Saturday guys in the rotation right now. And I was like, oh, that's actually a pretty interesting way to look at it. But I'm curious to see how it shakes out because, like, Liam Doyle looked pretty electric at times. It wasn't like a perfect outing by any stretch, but like he kept blowing fastballs, bastards, when he would get into a pinch. He had a couple of times where he like ran off the mound thinking he had strike three, but because the umpire was blind, like he had to walk back out there. He just looked like kind of
Let's take a one by one. I thought Doyle really interesting on Saturday. Again, he only goes 3.1 innings on a pitch count. I think he'd only thrown a season high of 31 pitches prior to the other night or the other day. He's 75% on a strike rate on Saturday, just filled it up. I know he walked a guy early. I know he hit a guy early, but the two things that he did that really impressed me, one was he just threw strikes. I mean, I think it was 58 pitches, 44 strikes, if that math's right. And then he got out of jams. He didn't freak out. He was a kid who stranded two runners with three straight strikeouts in the second inning after back-to-back singles. He walked and hit a guy in the first inning, got out of it without anything really happening there. I mean, I thought his mentality was great. He's a confident guy. He's done it before to some level. You know, Mike's over-exaggerating that a little bit because he was not this week after week after week full-time starter there at Coastal Carolina. But he did start a game in the postseason. He blanked Ryder in the postseason for six innings. He's thrown in a regional. He's done a lot of things. He's got a great mindset about it. And that fastball does play. It was 90-94 on Saturday. The slider and the changeup are serviceable. They're fine at an SEC level. They're not huge out pitches, but they allow him to play off that fastball. But straight talent, he's first or second on the roster from a just straight talent standpoint, throwing that way from the left side and doing what he's doing at that point. So he's there. He's earned it. If you told me one guy to this point has looked like a Friday guy where he can get through this thing and kind of look dominant, it's Liam Doyle on Saturday. He was the most impressive, talented. Now, look, it's raw. He's got to throw that fastball in the strike zone. He can't get it elevated all the time. There's work to be done. But it's also the best show of talent we've seen from a pitcher so far this season.
I completely agree. And the been there, done that. I mean, from Mike's perspective, Kessinger had a note on the broadcast. Like, I believe he'd end up becoming their Friday night guy toward the end of the year because of a rash of injuries. I mean, from Mike's standpoint, he had two guys that won him a national title that did that. So maybe he's seen all he's need to see from that standpoint, even though it's a limited sample size. But at least you know he can project as a starter and actually, you know, I mean, no pun intended, not to repeat myself, but like has been there, done that to a degree. And I agree. I mean, sometimes it's hard to like tangibly describe it, but it just looked like a pretty good Friday night outing that looked like a ceiling that could be a pretty good Friday night arm in the SEC for Ole Miss. The fastball was very lively. He wasn't really afraid. He threw straight into the strike zone when he was behind in counts, ahead in counts. When he got into pinches, he really didn't allow errors to, I say errors, but mistakes to compound on each other. And I thought he looked really, really sharp. And if you showed me the three guys right now that you have on the weekend rotation, and you say who looks most like a Friday guy, like you mentioned, I think it's Liam Doyle. And I'm curious to see. I don't think this happens this coming week. I think they probably leave it the same because I don't think you can, after that one outing, 3 1/3 innings on a pitch count, you say, all right, this is our Friday guy, let's roll with it. Maybe they do. Maybe they say it doesn't matter and they like what he gives them on Friday. But I'm curious to see kind of what his ceiling is versus the other two guys, because talent-wise, I think probably, wouldn't you still say talent ceiling-wise, it's probably Saunier, but I wouldn't touch anything with what he's doing right now. He looks very comfortable. On Sundays, he's thrown 5 straight innings 3 weekends in a row. I would just kind of let him do his thing. But I just thought about it from the standpoint of, like, who of the three guys they have on the rotation right now have the highest ceiling? And Doyle's looked the most impressive, but I still kind of believe in the top-end talent of Saunier. And I don't know if that has anything to do with how this shakes out this year, but it was just an interesting way to think about it.
I agree with you. I think Saunier's a guy doing what he's currently doing to just leave him alone.
Yeah,
I think don't touch it.
Confidence,
let him sit there. He's got some confidence on a Sunday. Because look, every day of the weekend takes a different type of confidence. There, one's not necessarily better than the other, but when you throw it on Friday night, you're a tone setter. You sort of dictate momentum and tempo even more than you realize or you should, because baseball can be a dumb game at times. There on a Friday night, on Saturday, you're either clinching a series or you're trying to save it from going hell to a handbasket. Both those are true depending on a swing of that. And you got to be able to handle both those things effectively. And then on Sunday, there's a lot of pressure on that day. You're trying to just hang in the game. You don't necessarily have the bullpen available that you might have earlier in the weekend. There's some weird stuff. Offenses get crazy. You're just trying to hang in there. And then you're trying to win a series, turn it into a great weekend, or absolutely salvage a game. And there's nobody left. There's not tomorrow to fix it. So I think if Saunier can be comfortable in that role, you just let him go in that role. I agree with you both ways. I don't think Mike's going to shift it this week because they're winning, and he's not one to touch stuff and tinker ahead of time like that. But at the same time, if it were me, and I'm fine to eat these words if it happens and they don't do well, I would go Doyle, Dennis, Saunier. I just think Doyle has a little more upside there on a Friday. He's done it before. And with Dennis, I really, really like his resolve, the way he's hung in there. He's stranded a lot of runners. He's done a lot of things well. You know, he probably was sharper this week than he's been at any other point. I think he is gaining some confidence at D1 level too. And I don't mean this in any way taking away from him, but there the first couple starts, he had a whip up around two. He was leaving a lot of guys on base. He was doing some things where I went, you're getting out of it, and you get full credit for that. But you're also one ball in the gap from this thing getting a little funny there at times as well. I just, because of the way he pitches and the necessity for him to throw strikes, and maybe if he does that, he does hang in the game longer and he saves some bullpens and different things. There's something about him on Saturday that I just really like as far as setting up a profile of a rotation.
He's got that big, like, sweeping breaking ball that he hangs up sometimes, and then he doesn't look like he has the same ability as Doyle to, like, elevate the fastball and actually get by people. And to your point, I mean, he had the whip around two, and everything looks hard, and he has great resolve, and he's getting out of these jams. But, I mean, really just naturally in the SEC, you're not going to get out of those at nearly the high frequency. And not only that, can you not get out of them, those can compound into gigantic innings a whole hell of a lot easier. So I'm with you there. It looked more Saturday-ish to me. He's been good. I don't mean to knock him in that sense, but I would do that if I were Mike as well, but I don't think he ends up changing it. I don't really blame him for it, but I'm on the same boat as you there. I would probably flip those two, at least for the time being. What do you think about the idea of having two lefties back-to-back? Is that something Mike prefers?
He would like to split it up and go one, you know, 1-2-1 or whatever, and have the odd man out in the middle, but I think he's okay with that. You know, Mike hasn't had left-handers for a long time, and I think he's sort of taking that personally a little bit when we keep talking about the lack of depth in left-handers. Because even before the season started, I asked him that question in that preseason press conference, and he's like, you know, I had a coach in the SEC the other day call us left-hander you. And I was like, well, you need to tell everybody else that whenever. And
who is that guy?
Well, his point was, you know, a lot of their stars have been left-handed. You know, you look back through the past, and Nikhazy and Pomeranz and Rollison, and they've had left-handed people that have been very effective. Christian Tran obviously was very important to that 14 team there and being on the left side. But depth-wise, come on, they haven't had a lot of left-handed talent. And, I mean, I do commend him because, look, you knew the score on one of these guys. You've known it for 2 years. But at the same time, this is a roster that was originally supposed to have Xavier Rivas and Hunter Elliott on it.
Yep.
And those are two left-handed arms and guys that aren't there. So, I mean, I do commend him in that way of how he's put this thing together and got him some guys in different ways. And I said 5-run 8th. It was not a 5-run 8th. It was 2-run 6th and then a 3-run 8th today for Morehead State. But point standing, their bullpen has been quite good. They got 5 scoreless out of Saunier on Sunday, struck out 3, 1 walk. I've seen a little message board chatter about lack of strikeouts, but I really like how he's throwing strikes and pitching to contact right now. I don't need Saunier to go strike out 12. I need him to go throw ground balls if I'm Mike. I need him to just do the things that he's doing, not walk people and gain confidence that way. He threw 66 pitches and threw 46 strikes today. I'll take that every single time. Austin Simmons, a little bit of a tough luck outing, but he gives up 3 hits and 2 walks. So a lot of base runners there. Kind of lucky they only got 2 runs across, 2 earned runs across there in 0.2 innings. Mason Morris was excellent. He struck out 2. 1.1, and then Mallett's does give up 3 hits and 3 runs in 2 innings, but he kind of still locked it down, finished the game, got 3 up, 3 down there in the night for the save. So he redeemed himself big time there for Mallett's. And I'm not trying to get too caught up on Sunday's game. My point being, they come into Sunday, I think the bullpen had not allowed an earned run in 22 innings, 22 and a third, something like that, coming into the weekend. Or sorry, coming into Sunday, where do you guys, and I'm sure you answered this question, because I'm kind of in the middle. I like Mallett's. I like what Braden Jones has done. Love what Mason Nichols has done. He hasn't allowed a run yet this season, and in the times that they've used him, he's up to 8 innings or whatever it is. I know the competition is what it is, because you even look up and Iowa lost a weekend to Jacksonville State this weekend, so it hasn't been world beaters on who they've played. But in saying that, overall, how do we trust this bullpen? I think I trust them because they throw strikes.
I do too. And it's guys in a lot of senses that have done it before. It's Mitch Morels. It's Josh Mallett. It's smaller sample size. We figure Riley Maddux will factor into that at some point.
Braden Jones has thrown innings. Yeah.
Yes, he has thrown innings. It's even guys like that they haven't really gotten many innings yet for. Like Samson DeCoyan's allowed 2 base runners this year. He has 3 outings where he's only spanned 4 innings total. But he's only allowed 2 base runners, and he looked pretty sharp coming in relief in the Friday game. And so it's a guys that they've sneakily experienced and have done it before, and it doesn't look fluky at all because of what you mentioned. They throw strikes. I think this could end up being the greatest strength of the team. And I think if they end up in a world on Friday night to where they don't have they're not going to go into hardly any Friday nights this year where it's like they have a massive pitching advantage. But if you can just find someone like a Doyle and everything we just discussed to go get you through the 5 innings and be really, really effective in those 5 innings, having that kind of bullpen depth and having a guy like Mallett's where you can just give him the baseball for the final 12 outs and say, just go get it and we'll handle the rest of the weekend with whatever we have left in the pen is going to help this team a lot. And I think if this team ends up reaching their ceiling, it's because the bullpen covered a lot of innings. It was really, really good for them, particularly in the first 2 games of a series.
Eating better is easy with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to go in just 2 minutes. You'll have over 35 different options to choose from every week. Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, Keto. Also, 60 add-ons help you stay fueled up and feeling good all day long. So what are you waiting for? Get started today. Get after your goals. Everything from pancakes, smoothies, and more. Discover a wide variety of easy options for the entire day, like breakfast, midday bites, and more. No prep, no mess meals. Factor meals are always ready to heat and eat. So there's no prepping, no cooking, no cleanup needed. Flexible for your schedule. Get as much or as little as you need by choosing your meals every week. Plus, you can pause or reschedule deliveries any single time. They got 2-minute meals when you need to fuel up fast. Restaurant quality meals ready to heat. Again, whenever and wherever you are. It's the perfect solution. If you're looking for fast premium options with no cooking required, sign up and save. We've done the math. Factor is less expensive than takeout, and every meal is dietitian approved. To be nutritious and delicious, so head to factormills.com/MPW50. Use code MPW50 to get 50% off. That's code MPW50 at factormills.com/MPW50.
Prom Shrimp.com, a lot of different flavors for you. The soy ginger is their most recent. Their best sellings are the signature. the New Orleans style barbecue shrimp. Awesome stuff there with Prime Shrimp. They deliver directly to your door. If you're the 10 minutes freezer to plate, they got full meals in a bag. And we're going to help you out. You can get a lot of your favorites. You can get a little bit of several different options and try those out. And do that by 5 pouches or more. Use code RG, 25% off, PrimeShrimp.com. Again, code RG with PrimeShrimp.com.
When you work with Argent Welts 401k advisory services team, you gain a valuable advisory team and time-saving resource that will help you develop and maintain a solid strategy for your retirement plan. They are committed to providing you with personalized attention and involvement that you want and need. Their goal is to help you manage your 401k plan properly and ultimately improve your employees' retirement readiness. It's myargentwealth.com, myargentwealth.com. We're brought to you by John Edwards of Regency Travel Incorporated in Memphis. If you are planning a trip and you want it to be one that creates a lifetime of unique memories, get in touch with John. Just give him some parameters. Give him a budget. He's going to give you options that you're going to have a difficult time finding on your own. It's that simple. 901-494-3387 or jedwards at regencytravel.net. Oxford's newest Greek restaurant on the square, Opa, is the perfect place for your company dinner, a festive party event. Also have catering options, fabulous food, great craft libations. Make OPA a part of your next trip to Oxford. Get in touch with them at 601-421-7147. We're also brought to you by Service Specialist Staffing and Recruiting Agency, connecting great job opportunities to candidates since 1967. If you're on the job hunt, it can help you with opportunities across the board. If your company is looking to hire quality, hard-to-find talent, they can help you as well. It's always free for the candidate. And keep in mind that payment of service is solely contingent on if your company decides to hire a candidate that they send. So you've got nothing to lose. Give Will, Sydney, or Kelsey a call at 601-573-9242 or check out their site, ServiceSpecialistLTD.com. Get the beautiful and healthy smile you deserve at Corinth Dental. Dr. Bubba McQueen, Dr. Jenny Beth Hendrick are devoted to restoring and enhancing the natural beauty of your smile using conservative state-of-the-art procedures that will result in a beautiful, long-lasting smile, from routine checkups to advanced treatment, including implants and Invisalign. Corinth Dental is here to help you achieve your smile goals. Schedule your appointment today. Take the first step toward a better version of yourself. It's CorinthDental.com.
Podcast is brought to you by the Ole Miss Athletics Foundation. Spring sports are underway. Single-game tickets for baseball are now on sale. Also, 2024 football season ticket and donation renewal deadline is March 31st. Got a few weeks left on that. So if you want to get your priority points up before seat or parking selections, call the Ole Miss Athletics Foundation, 662-915-7159. For further information, you can also visit givetoathletics.com, and they thank you for supporting Ole Miss student-athletes and say, go Rebels.
Ethan Leje had a hell of a weekend offensively. Coming into today, he had hits on 8 of his last 12 at-bats. I know he at least hit a home run today. Jackson Ross starting to pick up some regional and national recognition there, the FAU transfer, on just quality at bat after quality at bat after quality at bat. Fisher was kind of, you know, he was brought in through the portal to be a star, and he's hitting effectively right now. And then there's been some signs in a positive way with Luke Hill and Trayson Hughes, some other guys. The lineup from a 1-9 standpoint, I don't know where I stand on this now, but from a translation from the portal and what you expected and what you need, I think we're at a point. I want to see a little more. Again, they have South Carolina at home this weekend. SEC play starts. The real season begins now. But I think you've got a middle of the order with Ross and Leje and Fisher that is SEC legitimate, that is to some degree replacing what you lost last year in the middle of that order, which, you know, look, that was a tough task. We don't talk enough about the fact that this batting order lost Jacob Gonzalez, Kim Alderman, and Calvin Harris, three all-SEC bats last year. But you've got a really good three-part nucleus, I feel like, with Leje, Fisher, and Ross, that you can get a lot of stuff done if the rest of the lineup will just sort of be efficient, get some walks, put some guys on base, and not be stupid. You know, the problem last year is that Ole Miss didn't walk. Ole Miss didn't walk at all. They had so many bad, dumb at-bats, empty at-bats, stupid at-bats, all those things. The pitching has not been good they have faced. Look, don't get me wrong. Iowa has three good starters, but no bullpen to speak of at all. But the kid from Morehead State on Friday, I know it was a lot of infields, you know, a lot of singles through the infield and things, but he didn't really walk anybody coming in. He had started 40 college baseball games coming into Friday. They're showing a propensity to take walks, not swing at bad pitches. Maybe that TrackMan stuff from the fall and the early spring mattered here. I mean, we can talk about how many walks the opposing teams are giving up, but you cannot convince me that last year's set of Rebels wouldn't have found a way to swing at the pitches outside of the zone and make that a little less effective.
100%. I thought Kessinger in one of the broadcasts had a really good line, and it was like simple, but it made sense, where he said this team has walked, they've been given walks, they've gotten walks, and they've also earned walks. And so it's been kind of a combination of all three of those things. I'm sold at least on the top part of the lineup with for Leger, Fisher, Ross, you know, whoever they have behind them. I'm sold on the top half of the lineup. I think this will translate to SEC play. I realize like 2 weeks I could eat my words when they've cobbled together five runs over two series or something, but I'm pretty sold on that. Jackson Ross looks like, you know, maybe the most talented hitter on the team. All Fisher's done is hit. Leger's hot. And Leger had a good like last two-thirds of last year, but he struggled coming out of the gate, and then they were so bad so quickly that like it kind of got glossed over. And Groff's a good, you know, SEC hitter. He's a decent SEC hitter. I think he makes sense in the leadoff spot. What do you do with the final couple slots in that order? What do you do at DH? You know, can Furness be a guy that if you have an injury or something that he gets hot and kind of helps carry the middle or bottom part of the order for a couple of weeks? And then what do you get offensively with either catcher, I'm curious about? And then, of course, I guess the other facet of that would be, can you get Luke Hill or Trayson Hughes going at all? And what do you do if that doesn't happen? So the bottom of the lineup, I'm still very curious to see how much, if at all, that drags the top part down. But those first five, I'm sold on. I think I've seen enough.
Look, Ethan Leger today, I'm doing the quick math in my head here, 5.7. He's got an OPS of over 1,200. He's hitting 378 so far this season. He hit 243 last year. Again, we're not in conference play yet. Put all the caveats on it. But Ethan Leger last season wouldn't let you walk him. Wouldn't allow it. No matter what, he was swinging at something early in the count. You couldn't do it. I don't care how bad the pitching was. I don't care if it was Iowa bullpen bad. You could not walk Ethan Leger. This season, this is a hell of a thing. Mike even laughed about it. He goes, he's even walking a little. I mean, not a lot, but a little bit. Last year, 181 at bats. Ethan Leger walked 12 times, okay? 45 at bats this season. He's already walked 9.
That's remarkable. What a contrast there. And you can see a difference. And you're right. He wouldn't let you walk him. He looked a little Trayson Hughes last year where there were some swings where it's like, dude, what was that? Like, it's clearly pressing, like you're trying to get out of, you know, an early slump to start the season. But yeah, good on it. I mean, I think some of that comes from just being, you know, going through, you know, a non-conference season in major college baseball through a second time, which is why I think it will translate and hold up in the SEC this time around.
You mentioned catcher, and this is just a quick thought here to start the week. I'm going to think about this more, probably write about it a little more. I think I wrote about it maybe in the middle of last week. Campbell Smithwick has to hit to play at this point. I think Birch has been better defensively. Frankly, neither one of them are throwing out runners. I have not looked at updated stats. Coming into the weekend, they had each allowed 5 stolen bases. So as a team, they were 0-10 at one point with throwing out runners. But some of that's on the pitchers, and then you just got to hit. Now, I do think Smithwick is starting to come around with the bat. He's getting more comfortable. He's had a couple doubles at least. He's done some good things. Again, I have not looked at the updated stats, so I'm probably a little behind on that as far as what's happened the last few days. But then Birch gave you 3 hits last week. You're getting some offense in a place that, you know, you don't necessarily have to have it, but you need quality at bats. But, you know, where Smithwick's at, if he's going to hit, it's a high ceiling. It's going to get you there. It's the guy to play. But if he's not going to give you more than kind of replacement level offense, I think Birch is ahead here on March 10th. Now, Mike's thing is, and I don't think this is being critical toward anybody, Birch has a much lower overall prospect ceiling than Campbell Smithwick. I mean, Campbell Smithwick's a top 100 player out of high school, a kid who, is going to be the starting catcher for multiple seasons while he's in Oxford, no matter what happens today in this month or right now or this season. And I think Mike is aware of that, to where he's giving a long leash and he's really trying to work on development if he can get him there.
So do you think he continues to platoon him, or they end up going with someone?
I think he would like to platoon him to some degree because he has to. I mean, Campbell Smithwick doesn't need to catch every single game all season and do it that way. I mean, you've got to.
Yeah, I'm talking beyond your typical midweek he doesn't catch type thing. Like, I'm talking about lefty-righty matchup, which seems somewhat what he's doing already throughout the course of the week.
I think for now that's where he's at because, look, even his verbiage has changed. I picked up on this over the last 3 weeks. I ask about both catchers after maybe a midweek game a couple weeks ago. And Mike's comment was, hey, Smithwick's got to play because he's whatever. And, you know, look, Birch is the backup and you're going to get him enough to whatever, whatever. But he called him the backup. He used that of his own words. I didn't lead him. And that's where he went with it. And then the other day, this past week, I asked a similar question. And he said, I wouldn't even call him a backup. They're just platooning. Okay. So he out of his own.
I'd have gotten your answer there.
Yeah, he out of his own mouth has changed the verbiage that he's using with those two guys over the past 10, 14 days. So, yeah, I think they're playing both until there's just some really obvious present reason to not do that.
Interesting. I actually asked Colin when the last time that happened, and he gave me a very out there answer about 2009. I'm curious if you remember anything about this.
Oh, yeah, definitely. 2009 was Brett Basham and Kyle Henson. In 2009, they were both playing for the majority of that season. Basham got platooned most of his career because in 2007 it was Alex Kleeman and Basham that were platooning. In 2008, Basham was SEC Defensive Catcher of the Year. He played all year.
So, and then he mentioned something to the effect of it was actually not your traditional platoon because both those guys actually hit the same way, but they would DH Matt Snyder when one of them played and like wouldn't the other. He was like, this is not a typical answer. I just took his word for it.
He was an obvious defense platoon, not a left-right platoon.
Okay, that makes sense.
In a way. I mean, if that makes sense. And I'm gonna get this wrong, but Mike's played multiple catchers to some degree. I mean, it might have even been Cooper Johnson and Fortes a few years ago. Again, I may have the names wrong, but
being tired of Johnson not hitting, if you remember correctly. They're just like, to hell with it, we'll play Fortes at catcher.
Yeah. But I think some of that is this, just in reverse. It's, look, if Campbell Smithwick gets better defensively, this isn't going to be a platoon.
Fair enough.
I mean, so it's Birch hitting and it's Smithwick defensively and kind of what each one of those comes around as time goes on. I think that's where this team is sitting right now.
That makes some sense.
But this weekend's huge. Look, I mean, again, we'll talk about this later in the week as we get closer, but South Carolina comes to town. They're good, but they're gettable. And you got a trip to Knoxville looming. You really need to start off strong here at home, one of these five series, because Ole Miss last year, and there's no reason to analyze it. What happened was they went 6-24 because everything snowballed in every direction. I understand that. However, in saying that, they got off to a horrific start playing Vanderbilt and Florida and getting drummed and getting beat and not finding some momentum in different ways. And then, two, they didn't win home games. I think they went 3-12 in their 15 home games last year, and two of those were against Georgia.
Which is crazy to think about, but you're exactly right. I mean, that game two against Florida where they couldn't get the outs to close off that game, that really felt like, I mean, death sentence is very reactionary at that point in the season, but it was like, man, now you're at best 1-5, and then I believe they went to College Station the next week. It's like, how in the world is this getting turned around? So you're right. I mean, look, if this doesn't get off to a great start this coming weekend and you have a road trip to Knoxville, like, really good teams have a hard time coming out of 1-5 and 1-6 holes. And I wouldn't describe this team as a really good SEC team. So them taking two this weekend and getting off to a good start is paramount. I mean, I always say this and I hate myself for it after, but like, it's an uncharacteristically important March series. I'll say that about March and April all the time. And like, it doesn't really make any sense, but this, for this team and where they're situated and kind of what they're dealing with some moving parts, feels very important.
So they're going to get two against South Carolina this weekend?
I gave him two, and I didn't really have a ton of logic behind it. It was just somewhat optimistic in the fact that the series was in Oxford. That was pretty much my entire logic behind picking them to take two this weekend.
If it was in Columbia, you would change your mind?
I'd probably say they'd be nice to get out with one, but they would probably need to go fight the schedule makers if they did have to go to Columbia and then Knoxville back-to-back to start the SEC season. Mike would probably need to call the SEC office, if that were the case. That would be unfair.
Oh, just because you and I haven't talked about it, how you liking the creams?
I think so. I actually asked Colin about this because I noticed him for the first time Friday because I was tied up the week before. I know there was a lot of like criticism about like really if you're going to do a cream when it's that boring. I think it's fine. I think it looks nice. I like the hat. I like it a lot too. I don't really have any complaints. I'm not a huge like jersey connoisseur, partially because I'm part colorblind. So I don't think I could brand myself as some sort of fashion icon when it comes to sports jerseys when I can't really see some of them that blend together. But I do know what looks terrible sometimes and what doesn't. I think this looks good. I thought they did a fine job. I've glossed over this whole Nike story. Why didn't they have these on time? What was the deal with this?
Well, I mean, Nike has screwed up everything from a team side. I was told they got really behind because they had all that. They had the Super Bowl contract, and they couldn't place a ton of the Super Bowl. And then when MLB got pissed off and all that happened, they just simply didn't get their crap. And I mean, the thing is, it was much more far-reaching than people realize because, I mean, think about it. Arkansas, LSU, and Ole Miss were affected and didn't have jerseys on time. If three SEC schools didn't have their stuff, what do you think that D2 school from Kansas, like how long do you think it's taken to get their crap?
They might not have them this year.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Well, I mean, look, Ole Miss softball was affected, and I knew at one point they were told they might not have one of their suits until April.
Wow. That's interesting. I never even really noticed that, which shows
I will say this about the cream, and I hate to even go here out loud because some people hate it and are going to nod along and go see. It does look like the same sort of template as that MLB suit a little bit. It is a suit that looks great on the field from the stands or on TV. It's my favorite suit Ole Miss has. The cream is the best one on TV. But up close, it doesn't look as well made. Like when you're right talking to the guy with the jersey like 2 feet in front of you, it looks a little more nippy on the construction. Yeah.
Interesting. Maybe Nike should get out of the business of baseball jerseys. Doesn't sound like they've had rave reviews.
Couple of series, and again, we'll do this later in the week too, but two that really stick out to me outside of Ole Miss, I think there are three fascinating series to start league play. The number one series is by far Texas A&M, who's still undefeated. They needed a comeback and extra innings to knock off Rhode Island on Sunday to get the sweep and stay there. They're in Gainesville this weekend for a really good series to start league play. And then LSU, Mississippi State, just to kind of see, stayed at home. Do they have any pulse? They're trying to get off the mat a little bit, kind of like Ole Miss, except even though I think State's worse than Ole Miss. So they've got LSU. And then a bit of a prove-it series for Alabama. They've played well so far in the non-league. They've got the Tennessee Volunteers at home in Tuscaloosa to start league play. I don't buy it, but it's there. It's at least a chance. So we'll see where it goes.
Those are the three that stuck out to me, too. For a college baseball standpoint, Florida A&M seems like must-see TV. And then the other two, I'm just curious to see, like, is State going to be competitive or are we going to be talking about this Lamotas thing the second week of April? And then, of course, Alabama. It's like, okay, like, are you actually there yet? You got a hell of a shot here with Tennessee coming to Tuscaloosa.
Were you just down there and out for the wedding, or did you get anything else done in New Orleans?
Not really. It was wedding. We had like a little party dinner thing on Friday night. And then, I mean, we walked around like Bourbon Street and that whole area on Saturday and then went, the reception was at Brennan. So that was pretty cool. Oh. Yeah. So no, nothing really crazy other than the wedding. Got out there Friday night, came back this morning, but, nice trip to New Orleans. Great city. I enjoy it.
Ole Miss got a midweek against ULL here in Monroe. I guess the last time they did that was that the COVID year? Have they been back?
It'd be when the world shut down. They didn't play for quite a while after that. 2021 was actually the next time they played baseball.
Okay, so there we go. That trip to Monroe back in 2020, they are there this week for one game in the midweek. And then again, the South Carolina Gamecocks at home starting Friday for that one of the basketball team. They play Texas A&M 6 o'clock on Thursday there from Nashville with Bridgestone Arena. Football team has had two light practices, as they call them. They are taking the week off for spring break, and then they will return next week with the final bit of spring football prior to the Grove Bowl. We'll have coverage of that at RebelGrove.com as well. So, Brian, appreciate the late night. Appreciate your time. Thanks to all of you guys, all of our sponsors, and more. And we'll talk to you again, Derek.